Chapter 17. Draco walks down the pebbled path through tall Mediterranean pines. Their thick crowns are starkly outlined by the cobalt sky, upon which the first stars of the evening wink to life. He reaches out, brushing the thick bark of one of the trees with his fingertips. His mother had chased him through these gardens when he was little. He, the dragon, her, the hunter. They ran and ran until she caught him and they fell together to the ground, laughing. Draco wonders when his mother had last laughed in that way. When had he? Even in this dimming light, the majesty of the chateau is breathtaking. Draco hasn't been here since the summer of fourth year. It's smaller than he remembers it, but apart from that, everything else is still the same. The shutters are thrown wide, revealing the well-lit rooms. The doors are open, as though any and all guests are welcome, as though nothing bad would ever consider walking inside. And something about that certainty of safety, tugs at his heart. There's movement in one of the downstairs windows, and then Narcissa steps out into the dusk, almost aglow in her ivory robes, her hair loose and flowing white about her shoulders. He realizes then how much he's missed her, like an ever-present ache he'd learned to put to the back of his mind. She waits for Draco to approach her, but in the final moment loses her composure and hurries to him, wrapping him in her arms as she would when he was little. "My boy," his mother whispers, voice breaking as he presses his face into her shoulder and her hand rises to caress his hair. "My beautiful, brilliant boy." Tears form in Draco's eyes and he doesn't know why. But suddenly he's crying, pressing himself closer to her as though, if he can just get close enough, he'll be a child again. And her warmth and scent and love will engulf him and keep him safe from the entire world. Finally, she takes him by the shoulders and pushes him away. "Let me take a look at you." If she's surprised to see the scars, she doesn't show it. Still self-conscious, Draco lifts his hand to touch the uneven skin. "You look very handsome with them, darling. A real man." Draco nods, wipes at his eye. "Not right now," he mutters, blushing. "Sorry, crying like a child." "Who can you be a child with, if not your mother?" Draco lets out an exhausted huff, then smiles. "I've missed you." "I've missed you too," she says. There's the clearing of a throat, and Draco looks up to see his father standing in the doorway. He looks so much older, the thought comes like a punch to his gut. He's been living his life just assuming that his father will always be there, like a final safety net, a final backup plan. And Draco realizes that he can't rely on that assumption anymore. Soon, it will be his father who will need to rely on him. And if he's not ready when that time comes, the both of them will drown. "Father," says Draco, and goes to hug him. His hug is as strong as it ever was, and it helps push back some of the existential dread that has suddenly filled Draco. "There is time," he tries to tell himself. "There is still time." "Come inside," says Narcissa, as though Draco's sudden appearance was completely anticipated. "We're about to sit for dinner." Dinner is an elaborate affair, as it always is with his parents. Numerous small courses served one after the next in a seemingly endless procession, though it's served at a small white wicker table in the sunroom instead of the large dining hall. "We are on vacation here," his mother had told him when he'd asked about it as a child. "Our meals should be casual." And they were. Draco was allowed to come to the dinner table in shorts. His father refused to wear shoes outright. Only his mother maintained some semblance of decorum, never failing to dress up for their evening meal. As they eat, Draco tells them about everything that has happened to him over the past few months since meeting Potter. He doesn't mention his and Potter's dalliance, but the way his mother eyes him over the rim of her glass is enough indication that she knows. "You sound like you think you're the only Slytherin in the world dealing with this," Lucius says after a while. "What do you mean?" asks Draco. "Every Slytherin in Britain is dealing with the auras," Lucius replies. "In fact, I'd say you've gotten off rather lightly until now. I suspect that it's because you haven't been using magic. Potter showing up in your life must have brought their attention back to you." "Hardly surprising." "I don't understand," starts Draco. "Draco," Narcissa says, placing a soft hand onto Draco's, "your classmates and their families were executed in the cleanup, and many of our colleagues and friends, but Slytherin is one of only four houses. To execute all the Slytherins in Wizarding Britain, the Ministry would have needed to wipe out a fourth of its population. No government that wishes to survive would approve of that." "I would have thought that was obvious," says Lucius. "He hasn't been reading the news, darling," his mother says, touching his father gently on the arm. Lucius rolls his eyes. "Only the uneducated and fools don't read the news," he says. "Lucius," snaps Narcissa. "The news doesn't affect my life," says Draco, sending his mother a grateful look. "No," his father responds, "of course it doesn't. You've retreated into the manor and your business." The distaste in his voice tells Draco everything he needs to know about his father's opinion on shipping. "And you think the world is just magical and safe. A beautiful, friendly place where Slytherins can share living quarters with Gryffindors, and it's all fine and dandy. Well, this issue with your port is hardly surprising. You've strayed out of your allocated lane, my darling son, and they're going to make sure you pay for it."
"Merlin, father, it's this kind of talk that got us into this mess in the first place. This is the kind of rhetoric that helped the Dark Lord return to power. Was it not enough for you? Were two wars not enough?"
"For me," laughs Lucius, "none of this has anything to do with me. I've retired, you see, banished to France for the rest of my days."
"At least it's not Azkaban," snaps Draco.
Lucius purses his lips and looks away, the unspoken, "It may as well be Azkaban," hanging heavily over the table.
"So," his father says finally, "you don't want revenge?"
"No, I don't fucking want revenge. Father, if we go out to get revenge, this will never be over. The war was revenge, and then the cleanup was revenge. And now what? Us again, and then them again. And where does it end? And is there even an us and them, if we are one and the same?"
"Well," says Lucius with a careless shrug, "maybe the Slytherins want revenge. We're belittled and badgered. Some of us, banished. Others stripped of their property. Hundreds of witches and wizards have taken on jobs for next to no pay, just to survive, because no one is hiring Slytherins. All Slytherins, Draco, not just those who still bear the mark."
His father pulls out his wand and waves it. Nothing happens. Then abruptly dozens upon dozens of little folds of parchment fly into the room and stop to hover over the table.
"Not over the dining table, Lucius," Narcissa says, and by the sound of her voice, it's not the first time she's said it. Draco reaches up and plucks one from the air. The words, "The rattle," are written by hand on the outer fold in the duplicatable ink. He unfolds the parchment to find a handwritten pamphlet or newspaper of sorts.
"Is it time for us to fight back?" one of the articles asks.
72 Slytherins fired from Gringotts accounting offices," says another. "Ethereals lose fortune and manor in potions scandal.
Lumion Tobias Jr. still missing. Aura's close investigation.
10 ways to get your Slytherin child resorted.
Merlin, how bad is it? If parents think forcing their children to go against their own nature is better than letting them be known as Slytherins.
What is this?" he asks his parents, waving the rattle.
"An underground gazette," says Narcissa. "It's rumored to be run by one of the disinherited Slytherins, though the author never gives her name. For safety reasons, of course. Your father never misses an issue."
"It's being passed from hand to hand," Lucius says. they're afraid to use owl post. Draco skims one of the articles. It says here that we're being oppressed and that Slytherins should start retaliating against the other houses. He crumples the paper in his fist. Is this? He asks his father, trying to keep his voice under control. Is this what you truly believe? Lucius is silent for a while, face turned away from Draco, expression thoughtful. No, he says eventually, carefully. But they're not making those articles up. This is what's happening in England. Britain's Slytherin population is suffering. Most of these people didn't even have anything to do with the war, and I don't know how much longer they'll be willing to shrug the injustice off. Retaliation will only give them a reason to destroy us for good, says Draco, as his empty soup plate is replaced by a summer salad of blackberries and kale with a pop. Then what do you recommend? Asks Narcissa. Draco moves the ripe blackberries around his plate, thinking. I think, he says finally, I think we need to reintegrate. He looks up at his parents to gauge their reaction. No one is going to let us do that, says Lucius. No, agrees Draco, not like this. But there must be a way. Muggles have gone through thousands of wars that tore right through their societies. They couldn't have just executed everyone with the smallest connection to the losing side. They must have policies, solutions that allow people to live in peace, together, even after wars. Reconciliation, his father says thoughtfully. Yes, says Draco. And who will lead this wild campaign? Asks Lucius. Me. Lucius raises an eyebrow, says, alone? No, says Narcissa, realization dawning on her face. No, he has Potter. First, his father tells him, once the three of them finally retire to the elegant drawing room with its enormous windows and soft velvet couches. First, you'll need to speak to every member of the Wizengamot individually. You'll need to remind them how much our family has done for every one of them. We haven't done much, Draco says. Draco, darling, do you truly believe that just because your father is in exile, he would ever allow his contacts to fall away? And no, now that Draco thinks about it, he cannot imagine a world in which his father would ever be able to step back from his meddling. Every wizarding family has had members in Slytherin, she continues, members that had been on the wrong side of this war or the last or the one before it. No family is purely good or evil. Eventually, everyone has to face the side of themselves they don't want to look at. I doubt that telling the Wizengamot that it has a dark side too will in any way endear me to them, Draco says. No, says Lucius, but the promise of reintegration will. How so? Asks Draco. Chief Warlock Fillion has a daughter that was sorted into Slytherin at the beginning of this year, Lucius replies. And now her policies against our house no longer affect only strangers. They'll be affecting her blood. She will jump on a chance to support rehabilitation for Slytherins. Then there's Matilda, says Narcissa, lifting the teapot with a flick of her wrist. Matilda Warbeck? Asks Draco, watching the tea pour into his mother's delicate baby blue porcelain cups. His mother hums in agreement. Matilda was Geoffrey Zabini's lover for... Oh, I don't know. They reconnected the year Blaise joined Hogwarts. After an hour of this, Draco finally realizes that there isn't a single person on the entire Wizengamot that doesn't have family members, lovers, friends, or all of the above that were or are in Slytherin. So what do I do? Asks Draco. Set up a charity organization for victims of the war? Have Slytherins and their families donate to it? That's a start, says Lucius, but one won't be nearly enough. Our family hardly has the funds to spearhead more than that, says Draco. We don't, Lucius says, but our friends do, and all of them have a vested interest in rehabilitation. Draco nods. Your mother shall organize a dinner for the families that are currently in France, says Lucius. We'll see how much support you have after that. Each family will dedicate members and resources to righting the wrongs of the war, says Draco, nodding. Orphanages, hospitals, magical community rehabilitation, the restoration of buildings. If we help rebuild Wizarding Britain, we can become a part of it once more, says Narcissa. Exactly, Draco replies with a smile. You've fallen in love, says Narcissa the next morning, as they stroll through the gardens. What makes you say that? Asks Draco. Nothing inspires one to grow quite like love does, she says. It exposes all of our weaknesses, makes us wish to be a better person, so that we may shine more brightly in our lover's eyes. She glances fondly at Lucius then, who is sitting at a small table, playing chess against his magical chess set. It's an odd new pastime, Draco finds, and not only because of its mundane nature. He'd always thought that if his father had time for frivolities like hobbies, he'd take up arithmancy or magical watchmaking or something equally magical and complex. But he seems quite content among his figures, and Draco, who hasn't felt content in years, can hardly begrudge him that. We cannot be together, Draco says, trying to keep his voice neutral. Ah, Ginevra Weasley. Draco nods. Of course she knows her by name. There isn't a pure blood in all of Wizarding Britain whose name his mother doesn't know off by heart. Yes, and though he's assured me that he'll be divorcing, he and I, we're still on opposing sides. Narcissa stops and turns to face Draco. She reaches up and touches his cheek with cool fingertips. Some build those they love a home, she says, and you will build a bridge, which you and Harry may cross to reach one another. Draco nods, looks away from her. Funny, how after all these years, all this life, her belief in him is still unshakable. And Draco, says Narcissa, drawing his attention back to herself. Yes, Mother. I'm glad you've decided to become the man you were always meant to be. He smiles at her then. It's hard to describe how much he'd yearned for this simple recognition. She's heard him, seen him, and in her acknowledgement of him, he has become tangible. He exists. There's a loud pop, and a house elf appears in front of them. Mrs. Malfoy, it says, your guest has arrived. Narcissa thanks the creature. Draco raises an eyebrow. Who is it? He asks. But Narcissa merely takes him under the arm and leads him back towards the house. In the foyer, a young man is standing, bent over, smelling the bouquet of wildflowers Narcissa had arranged there. He straightens and looks at them, and Draco's heart jumps into his throat. Hello, Draco, he says in a deep voice, much deeper than it had been when Draco had last heard it. Blaze, Draco breathes. You're alive,